Les colloques du Collège de France.
So thanks a lot Hugues for the invitation, and so I'm very pleased to be here, and I will just present you what we are doing in our lab regarding trying to identify genetic vulnerabilities that are at the interface between DNA damage response and the antitumor immunity to try to find new treatments for patients. So at the disclosure, I have financial disclosures. Oh, it's not working. Yeah. And I have a second disclosure, which is that I'm a medical oncologist by training. So this is an overview of the presentation, which I'll first give an example of synthetic lethality in ERCC1 deficient non-small cell lung cancer, a second one in PBRM1 defective clear cell carcinoma, and then as a clinician I will try to explain you how we try to translate this into a clinical trial, and finally I will give you some unpublished results about a novel synthetic lethality that we identified and on which we are collaborating actually with Philippe. So as a background of what I'm going to talk about today, what I said we are interested in is one of the hallmarks of cancer, which is genome instability and mutation, which, as you nicely heard from Raphael, can be targeted through synthetic lethality, the best example being the use of PARP inhibitors in BRCA-defective tumors. But you have other hallmarks of cancer, and the other one, another one actually, is that cancer cells can escape the recognition by immune cells, which normally should destroy them. And this can be targeted by other drugs, such as the PD-1, PD-L1 inhibitors. And these hallmarks actually are not independent. So what we try to do is to find novel therapeutic approach, which really try to leverage on this interdependence between hallmarks. So there are several levels of interdependence between the immunogenicity and the DNA damage response. The first one is what we call the antigenicity, which is the ability of tumor cells to present immunogenic neoepitopes and prime the T cells. The second one is what we call adjuvanticity, which relates to the ability of tumor cells to attract and activate the T cells at the site of the tumor through the production of neoadjuvant molecules. And the final one is reactogenicity, which the ability of tumor cells to trigger the function of T cells once they are at the site of the tumor and then kill the tumor cells. And DNA damage can basically modulate all these three characteristics, and what I'm going to focus on my talk is the modulation of adjuvanticity, which is basically the ability to attract these T cells. So how can DNA damage basically modulate this? One example is the activation of the cGAS-STING pathway, of which I'm going to talk about later. Basically, when you get some genome instability, what can happen is that this will release some DNA in the cytosol. It's completely abnormal for a cell to have DNA in the cytosol. Usually, it means that you have a viral infection or something weird else going on, and that may be recognized by a system called cGAS, which would activate STING, the phosphorylation of TBK1, the trigger of a type 1 interferon response, and this type 1 interferon response through the nucleus will trigger the release of what we call cytokines, such as CCL5, which will attract the T cells. So what has been described is that this can occur in the cancer cell, but also, this can occur in immune cells. When cancer cells are dying, they can be eaten or engulfed by immune cells, and then these immune cells will activate the T cells through interferon production as well as antigen presentation, and then these T cells will go and kill the tumor cell. Basically, we heard about several DNA damage response pathways before, and it has been described that virtually all DNA damage response pathways can activate these cytosolic immune responses. So in my talk, I'm going to talk about three different enzymes. First one is ERCC1. Second one will be CETIX and PBRM1. And first one is BRCA that you just heard about. And how does this crosstalk occur? Basically, in this, replication stress plays a crucial role. When you have acute replication stress through stalled forks, this will release a variety of nucleic acid fragments in the cytoplasm following the processing and the repair of the replication fork, which can be single-strand DNA, double-strand DNA, and other forms of DNA. But when you have some chronic replication stress, this results to chromosomal instability, which favors the formation of micronuclei, which are small nuclei within the cytoplasm, which have DNA plus proteins, which are histones, which is called chromatin. And these micronuclei will rupture. This will release the DNA, and this will activate the cytosolic immunity. So within the cytosolic immunity, I will first talk about the cGAS-STING pathway, and I will end up with the pathway that recognizes double-strand RNA that can also be present in the cytoplasm. And what is also important to keep in mind is that when you get an acute interferon response, this will create an anti-tumor phenotype. But when you get a chronic stimulation of this pathway, this will promote the tumor growth. So the dynamic of the activation of this system is very important. So the question we try to address is, can we therapeutically exploit this DNA damage response through synthetic lethality to try to enhance the tumor cell immunogenicity? So the first work we performed was in ERCC1 deficient non-small cell lung cancer. Basically, in non-small cell lung cancer, you have a variety of DNA damage response defects, and the most frequent one is ERCC1. What ERCC1 does, and you already heard about this pathway before, it's nucleotide excision repair and interstrand crosslink repair. It favors the repair of adducts onto the DNA. And through the creation of an isogenic model of ERCC1 defects, we could identify that the ERCC1 defective cells, here in purple, were sensitive to PARP inhibitors that you heard about during the second talk. So this was a synthetic lethality. And at this stage, we did a very simple experiment, which is that we profiled the transcriptomic profile of the ERCC1 defective cells, and we compared it to the wild-type cells. And what we could identify was a downregulation of the cell cycle and other DNA repair processes in ERCC1 defective cells, as we expected. But very interestingly, we observed an upregulation of the immune pathways in these cells in the absence of any immune microenvironment. So when looking closer at what was upregulated, we saw very important chemotactic chemokines that can attract the T cells, as well as an enhanced expression of the STING protein that I talked to you before, and as well as cGAS. And interestingly, when we had ERCC1, this protein was not expressed. But when we re-expressed ERCC1, we could see a re-expression of STING. And so really highlighting that there was an anti-correlation between the two expression of these two proteins. Then we ask, is that clinically relevant? And we assess the infiltrates of lymphocytes in ERCC1 low and ERCC1 high tumors. And what we could observe is that when you had ERCC1 low, you had more lymphocytes in the tumor, showing that potentially this was clinically relevant. We then asked whether the synthetic lethality with PARP inhibitor could be exploited to enhance this immunogenicity that was already present in the tumor. And what we did is that we assessed the formation of the cytoplasmic chromatin fragments that I talked to you about, which are these really small micronuclei present in the cytoplasm. And in ERCC1 proficient cell, we could see a small increase of the formation of these micronuclei on exposure to PARP inhibitors. But in ERCC1 defective cells, you can see we accumulate much more micronuclei in the ERCC1 defective cells. In the heterozygous cell line, it's intermediate. And when you re-express ERCC1, you abrogate again the formation of these micronuclei. What we then showed is that these micronuclei were formed during mitosis and contained heterochromatin. So these were real micronuclei, just not cytoplasmic chromatin fragments. And what was also interesting is that we see exactly the same phenotype in BRCA defective cells, with BRCA mutant cells having high levels of micronuclei, BRCA revertant cells, which are resistant cells, which have a functional BRCA protein, having no micronuclei, and cells in which PARP1 is lost, which are resistant to PARP inhibitor, and PARP cannot be trapped, and we can discuss about the trapping later, at least they do not accumulate micronuclei either. So this shows that the function of trapping of PARP is important about the creation of this phenotype. Then we ask whether this could trigger the type 1 interferon signaling and the cGAS-STING cascade. And we did observe that upon exposure to PARP inhibitor, you can phosphorylate TBK1, you can have a release, selectively in ERCC1 defective cells of CCL5, which is a type 1 interferon response cytokine associated, and that this is fully abrogated, by the silencing of cGAS and STING here. And interestingly, when you treated these cells with PARP inhibitor, you could also see an increase in the activation of this type 1 interferon response. So this allowed us to propose the first model, is that in a cell, when you have a functional ERCC1, if you lose ERCC1, you will have a small accumulation of micronuclei. But then if you treat with a PARP inhibitor, you will stall the replication fork, increase the accumulation of micronuclei, activate the cGAS STING pathway, trigger the cascade that I told you about before, and potentially release CCL5 and potentially activate the T cells, or at least recruit them. What I didn't show you is that in parallel, you will increase the expression of the PD-1 and PD-L1 at the cell surface, and this triggers the rationale for combining PARP inhibitor with PD-L1. As I said, we find similar findings in the context of BRCA-defective cells. Interestingly, at the same time, another paper was published that said that the activation of the cGAS STING pathway occurred in dendritic cells, so in immune cells, but not in cancer cells. I'm going to tell about more about that later, coming from patient samples. So now I'm coming to the second story, which is PBRM1 deficiency in clear cell carcinoma. So PBRM1 is a tumor suppressor gene which belongs to a chromatin remodeling complex. So it's not a DNA repair gene per se. But what it does is that it interacts with several actors at the replication fork, notably ATM. It also plays a role in the maintenance of the G2M checkpoint as well as the centromeric cohesion. PBRM1 mutation, they mostly occur in a cancer which is called clear cell renal cell carcinoma. And it's a very important event there because it's an early event in the oncogenesis of the disease. It's 40% of these cancers which have the mutation in PBRM1. So in order to try to identify how we could target PBRM1 genetic vulnerability, we performed the siRNA drug sensitivity screen in PBRM1 proficient and PBRM1 deficient cells. And what we could observe is that the deficiency in PBRM1 sensitized to several PARP inhibitors, talazoparib, rucaparib, and olaparib. So because we used a model that was not clinically relevant at the beginning, we thought maybe this is cell type specific, and we assessed this in several cell line models. So we used the HAP1 model, which is a CML cell line, 7860, which is a clear cell renal cell carcinoma cell line, and a non-small cell and cancer cell line, as well as a non-iatrogenic panel. And here, every time, the light line is the PBRM1 deficient. And you can see, every time, we got a therapeutic window on PARP inhibitor, showing that this was actually cell type independent. And then when we re-expressed PBRM1, we could see a restoration of the resistance to PARP inhibitor, showing that loss of PBRM1 was causal in the synthetic lethality. Then we thought to ask, why does that happen, and what's the mechanism underlying this synthetic lethality? So the first thing we thought about is that these cells were deficient in the pathway you just heard about by Rafael, which is homologous recombination. So we assessed the formation of RAD51 foci, which shows that the pathway is working. And what we could observe is that actually these cells were able to form RAD51 foci. And even when you expose them to PARP inhibitor, the deficient cells here in light purple were able to form these foci. So they were not deficient in homologous recombination. So there was something else going on here. What we observed as well was a parallel increase in RAD RPA foci, which are the sign of the single-strand DNA. So we thought to assess then what was happening at the replication fork, because we had single-strand DNA present and the role of PBRM1 at the replication fork. And what we could observe was actually a decrease in the velocity of the fork in these PBRM1 defective cells in all models. This was associated with an activation of the G2M checkpoint, as shown by the phosphorylation of ATM-ATR, as well as the sensitivity to ATR inhibitors. So these cells presented some signs of replication stress. What we also observed is that there was an accumulation of the micronuclei, which are indirect signs of genomic instability and abnormal mitosis, in these cells, selectively in the PBRM1 defective cells. And this was associated, looking at the tumor data from the Tumor Cancer Genome Atlas, by an increase in mutational load. So at this stage, what we had was increase in replication stress, no defect in homologous recombination, increase in RPA foci, and a role of PBRM1 as a chromatin remodeler in the activation of transcription. So we thought to look at the structures which are called O-loops, which are hybrids formed by a RNA-DNA strands and a free DNA strand. And what we could observe is that in both PBRM1 defective models, we had some O-loops which were shared with the PBRM1 type cell line. But we also had a bunch of O-loops which were only present in the PBRM1 defective cells. And interestingly, in the PBRM1 defective cells, when you treated with PARP inhibitors, you could significantly increase the presence of O-loops. So we then thought to look at proteomic data that we generated in one of our models, and we saw that PBRM1, of course, was really downregulated. But you also had a downregulation of several O-loops processing factors, including a helicase called CETIX. And because this was only in one model, we thought to look at it in another model. And in this clear cell renal cell carcinoma model, we could clearly see that when we knock out PBRM1, we decrease the expression of CETIX. And when we restore the expression of PBRM1, we restore the expression of CETIX. So what we did was to overexpress an enzyme that degrades the O-loops, which is called RNase H1, to try to see whether these O-loops played a role in the sensitivity to PARP inhibitor. And when we did so, when we degraded these O-loops, we could restore the resistance to PARP inhibitor of the PBRM1 defective cell lines, but not of the PBRM1 proficient cell lines. And similarly, when we forced the expression of this helicase CETIX, we could restore resistance to PARP inhibitors. So this could allow us to propose a model, which is if you have a normal PBRM1 gene function, you have some baseline O-loop levels. If you disable PBRM1, you will increase your O-loop burden. You will cause replication stress, increased of DNA damage, macronuclei formation. This will trigger, which I didn't show you, the activation of the cGAS-STING pathway, and potentially increase the immunogenicity of the cell. So I show you here two models in which when you use PARP inhibitor in contexts where they cause synthetic lethality, they can enhance potentially the tumor immunity in a cell autonomous fashion. So then the question is, can we use that in patients? So in order to test this, we wrote two clinical trials, which were academic studies in which we selected patients based on a genetic alteration, which is supposed to predispose them to being sensitive to PARP inhibitors. And we designed the trial so that we could start with the PARP inhibitor and then to try to trigger this interferon response and then combine with the PD-1 or PD-L1. There were two trials, one with the PD-1, one with the PD-L1. So this trial recruited now more than 150 patients. But what we did, which was interesting, was to try to biopsy the patients pre-treatment on the PARP inhibitors and on the combination therapy. And what we did then was single cell analysis of these sequential biopsies to try to see the evolution over time of the cell composition, the pathway activation, and the TCR clonotypes. So I will give you two examples of patients' results. The first example was a patient with a BRCA2 mutant castration-resistant prostate cancer. So this is the integration of the three time points. It means that we have cells coming from the three time points, we put them together and we analyze them. And as you can see, we could confidently identify some cancer cells, prostate cancer cells, and cycling cells. And then when we looked at the evolution over time, you can see that these prostate cancer cells in orange and the cycling cells in blue are decreasing in abundance. At the same time, you see an increase in the CD8 T cells and in the NK cells, and this seems to occur as early as on PARP inhibitor. And actually, this patient responded to the drug. So as you can see, this is actually a liver from the patient. All these black dots now, this is the liver. This is metastasis. Again, the liver, metastasis here. And this is the liver after treatment. So you see no more metastasis at here. It's after three cycles of treatment. Now we looked at what happened in these cells that we biopsied. And here, this is a bit of a complicated graph, but I will drive you through it. In pink, you have the baseline. In green, you have the treatment PARP inhibitors. And in orange, you have the combination therapy. This is the pathway we are looking at. And these are every cell population. So in every cell population, you can see the three time points. And basically, so in here I've put in red the tumor cells, in blue the immune cells. We could see that it could activate the apoptosis in the cycling cells and in the prostate cancer cells, which correlates with the response and correlates with the decrease in the tumor burden. But what was most interesting to see is that we also saw the activation of these DNA sensing pathways in the prostate cancer cells and in the cycling cells as early as on PARP inhibitors, really suggesting that this was occurring in the cancer cells. We also see this activation in some population of immune cells, suggesting that this could actually happen in both. We then looked at the release of TCL5, which again occurred both in the cancer cells and in some immune cell subpopulations. And we also looked at the antigen presentation, which was also increased as early as on PARP inhibitors in cancer cells, as well as in myeloid cells, interestingly, which could be the cells that engulf the dying tumor cells and then present the antigen through a cross-presentation to immune cells. So we looked at the TCR, which are the T cell receptor at the surface of the cancer cell, of the immune cell. And what was interesting is that we had at baseline one TCR which was overrepresented. That's called hyperexpanded. These are the functional ones usually. The other one you don't really care about, the rare ones. And this TCR actually seemed to decrease on PARP inhibitor and then reappear on PARP inhibitor. But this is a quantitative assessment. So we look at a qualitative assessment to see whether this was the same TCR. And actually, it was this same TCR that was present at baseline that decreased on PARP inhibitor and that hyperexpanded again on combination therapy with the immune therapy. So this really suggested that the cGAS-STING pathway and interferon type 1 response was really important, and that all these other TCRs that are generated here, potentially recognizing new antigens produced by PARP inhibitors, are not really functional and the cell don't really care about. They are quite random and they are not immunogenic. So now I'm going to give you another example, second patient, RAD51 mutant non-small cell lung cancer. Here, a bunch of tumor cells, cycling cells. As you can see, this increased over the course of the treatment. And here again, we had no activation of apoptosis, no activation of cGAS-STING. I'm not showing that. But what I'm showing is that we could hope there could be a response because we had an activation of the TCR signaling pathway in the lymphocytes. But actually, this was associated with an increase in PD-1. So we blocked it with the PD-L1. So why did it not work? Well, we saw a concomitant activation of CTLA-4, which is another checkpoint. And that's quite interesting because you have clinical trials which have assessed PARP plus CTLA-4, which seems to be even potentially more efficient than PARP with PD-L1. So potentially something to look after here. And so now going to the final part of my talk, which will be slightly different, but which is in link with that, which is the identification of a novel synthetic lethality at the interface between DNA damage response and immunity. So this will be based on the BRCA deficiency, which, as you know, is the clinical setting in which actually PARP inhibitors are being used. It affects what we call the BRCA spectrum, so it means it occurs in different tumors, in breast cancer, in ovarian cancer, in prostate cancer, and in pancreas cancers. And as Raphael said, the use of PARP inhibitors has brought some benefit, but still the patient will always ultimately relapse, and we really need other approaches for this patient with survival that are very poor in some cancers, such as pancreas cancer. So we thought, well, we would carry on looking at the mechanism of PARP inhibitors and try to really understand how these drugs work and whether they could potentially activate other cytoplasmic sensors rather than just only the cGAS-STING as we previously described. So we used an isogenic model of BRCA deficient light, which was created in Chris Lord's lab. And this is a triple negative breast cancer cell line where you will have the mutant cell line is the one that does not have a functional BRCA. And the revertant cell line is a cell line that has a second mutation which has put back the protein in frame, which allows to have a functional BRCA cell line. So here, the revertant will always be in yellow and the one with the BRCA deficiency will always be in red. And this is a work performed by extremely talented, outstanding postdoc, Romain Chabanon, at the ICR, and then in Paris, and in collaboration with Philippe. So we were looking at this mechanism of PARP inhibitors, and of course we used basically an siRNA drug screen. So it means we used a panel of siRNAs, which were modulating all the sensors that I talked to you about, the cytoplasmic sensors that were recognized, double-strand DNA, single-strand DNA, double-strand RNA, single-strand RNA, and so on and so on. And we treated these cells with this siRNA panel. We had one control arm with no PARP inhibitor treatment, which I'm displaying here, and one treated arm with the PARP inhibitor treatment. And here I'm showing you the result of the control arm. In the absence of PARP inhibitor treatment, you can see that one of these siRNA was strongly synthetic lethal with the deficiency in BRCA. And this was the siRNA against a protein called ADAR1. So I didn't talk about ADAR1 before, so I'm going to give you a brief introduction about what this does. So it stands for adenosine deaminase, and it edits the RNA. It's an RNA editing enzyme, which transforms the adenosine into inosine, onto the double-strand RNA. It exists as three paralogs, and the one which we're interested in is the paralog ADAR1, the first one, which exists as two isoforms. One which is P110, which is located in the nucleus, and one which is P150, which is inducible by interferon and is located in the cytosol. And very interestingly, ADAR1, so it edits the RNA, so it could like cause neoepitopes and so on, but also it has a really important role, which is to prevent the detection in the cytoplasm of this double-strand RNA by RNA sensors such as MDA5. And the best clinical illustration is that in humans, when you have an ADAR1 deficiency, you get a type 1 interferonopathy that Philippe is expert about, which is called Aicardi-Goutier syndrome. So this is a really clinically relevant enzyme, even in human biology. So what happens in the cancer cell when you have, as I told you, if you remember one of the slides I showed, dichotomy between chronic and acute interferon signaling. So when you have a chronic interferon signaling, this will induce the expression of ADAR1. I told you it's interferon inducible. This will favor the A2I editing, and this will prevent from the recognition of these sensors. Okay? But then if you don't have ADAR1, what will happen? You don't edit your RNA in the cytoplasm. This will be recognized by MDA5, RIG1, and so on. This will trigger an interferon response, release of interferon beta, and this will be a positive feedback loop, which will cause a surge in cytokine production and inflammation. But what it also does is that it activates PKR, and this will cause a translational shutdown, which will favor apoptosis of the cell. So this was for the nuclear role of ADAR1. The cytoplasmic role of ADAR1, sorry. But over the past 2 to 3 years, there has been a bunch of papers which have been coming out describing also a nuclear function for ADAR1. Basically, the P110 isoforms facilitate the resolution of R-loops at telomeres. It also promotes the activation of ATR at replication fork by favoring loading of TOP1. And in the micronuclei, it also generates deoxyinosine residues on the DNA and prevents the formation of chromotrypsis. So there is two roles, one in the cytoplasm, one in the nucleus. So we had this novel synthetic lethality, and of course the first thing we tried to do was to revalidate it. Was it just a false positive of the screen? So we used our model, and instead of using high throughput, we first revalidated by siRNA. Then we validated by shRNA, and then by CRISPR-Cas9. So really something which is very potent, at least in this model. But then the question is that, is it specific of this cell line, or can we also see it in other models? So we use a variety of BRCA isogenic and BRCA non-isogenic models from various backgrounds, as you can see, like MEF, colorectal carcinoma, TNBC from mice, and so on. And we basically could revalidate this synthetic lethality across models and across species. So a very potent synthetic lethality. So what we then looked at was the nuclear consequences of this synthetic lethality. And we first, of course, looked at the formation of DNA damage. And we could see that the silencing of ADAR1 could selectively cause DNA damage, as measured by gamma H2X foci, in BRCA defective cells. And this was associated with accumulation of micronuclei potentially signing genomic instability, again selectively in BRCA defective cells. We then looked at replication stress, of course, because you may remember that this enzyme has a role in activating the replication stress response. And basically, we could see that, again, there was a selective accumulation of RPA foci, single-stranded DNA, in BRCA-defective cells upon ADAR1 silencing. And I'm showing you here only one model, but we've validated this into all our models. This was associated with activation of the replication stress response, as measured by the phosphorylation of CHK1. And then, of course, what we ask is that whether there was also a role of the cytoplasmic function of this enzyme in the synthetic lethality. So we, of course, first measured the activation of the cytoplasmic sensors that ADAR1 is supposed to prevent from the activation. And what we could see is that we could activate, upon ADAR1 silencing, these RNA sensing pathways selectively in the BRCA defective cells, but not in the BRCA proficient cells. And that this was associated with a type 1 interferon response as measured by interferon beta 1 and CCL5. So there was potentially also a role of the cytoplasmic function of this enzyme in the synthetic lethality. But so far, this was very descriptive, and we could not really see whether this was causative in the viability of the cell. So what we very naively do was to treat the cells with a drug that blocks the JAK1, which is one of the secondary response of the interferon pathway type 1 activation. And when we block JAK activation, we could rescue the synthetic lethality, showing that this cell autonomous activation of the type 1 interferon plays a role in the synthetic lethality. And conversely, when we treated the cells with type 1 interferon, we could cause the synthetic lethality in the BRCA proficient cells, showing that there was a kind of, this was the opposite experiment. If you're in the BRCA defective context and you block the interferon response, you will rescue the synthetic lethality. And if you're in the BRCA proficient context, but you will add interferon, you will cause the synthetic lethality when you silence ADAR. So this is really where we are in that story. So this is ongoing work. And basically, the conclusion of all this is that I think it's really interesting to try to understand really how the drugs work, because we proved that beyond the traditional DNA damage response function, PARP inhibitor can also activate the cell autonomous immunity. They can also influence the R-loop metabolism. This is something that we proved in the lab, that we have tried to translate in the clinic in academic basket trials. And the single cells that we did on pretreatment and untreated biopsies could really try to show that at least some of this was true, but other hypotheses were true as well, which is really important to know to better treat patients. And finally, this also allows us to identify a novel synthetic lethality between BRCA and ADAR1. So I thank you for your attention, and I really want to thank all these people who are contributing to this work. And first of all, Romain Chabanon, who is really outstanding and has been driving most of the work I presented today.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.